12 of them.
So that's what I wanted to talk about. I don't think it's worth it.
I don't know.
Well, we could, you know. Yeah, I don't know. I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I spoke to him about that we definitely needed him for the Friday when it was scheduled for Friday. But, yeah.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Okay. I wonder if you should go see if check to see if Representatives Wardlow or Simon are here.
Do I on the table?
Yeah. Sure.
Do we know where anybody else is?
Not necessarily. What's the form?
Well, we need at least two
of each
house, so we need one more. We can start hearing, you know.
Say, Mike, you bet. We could overview and then ratify when they get here.
Yep.
That's what we're going to do.
Yep.
Okay. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims, Monday, March 26, 2012. Members, we're going to proceed on the agenda until we get a quorum. We'll be hearing issues, laying them over for a vote when we attain a quorum. We are going to spend 2 hours this morning, and we will be done with the agenda by 10 o'clock. So the chair will be gentle, but we will control discussion and timing on this. Ms. Timmons? Can you get us started?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Would you like to start with the personal injury claims for the DOC, or?
Ms. Timmons, let's go with the item 3A.
Item 3A would be the medical reimbursement for the sentence to service matters, medical expenses that have been paid by the Department of Corrections. And they have submitted documentation for another $861.62 in medical expenses that occurred between January 14th of 2012 and March 14th of 2012. Thank you. It's on a separate sheet of paper.
I'll
get my copy.
So the total sum is $861.62.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay. What's next?
Okay. Next, I believe we would be going to the injury claims against the Department of Correction. And Mr. Hartnett, I believe, is here.
Yeah.
To testify.
It was 861.
Yep.
Have a seat.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're on the Bergeron claim. Sir, identify yourself and proceed.
My name is Randolph Hartnett. I'm Associate General Counsel for the Department of Corrections.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to summarize the case briefly?
Ms. Timmons, yes, please.
Yes, and for the record, I'm Michelle Timmons, the counsel for the committee. This is the case of Edward Bergeron. It is a claim for $5,000 or the cost of total tooth repair or replacement. The claimant was hit by a kitchen door on December 24, 2009 while at work. His tooth number 3 was chipped, and the chip was fixed quickly, but the claimant says he continues to have pain and requests state payment for treatment to restore the tooth. The dentist, Dr. Will, is of the opinion that the primary cause of claimant's tooth problem is decay, not the accident. Dr. Will is further of the opinion that the root canal claimant desires is risky and extraction would be a better option, but he does say that the tooth could be restored through a root canal and that would have to be at the claimant's own expense under the DOC policy. And I believe he's offered something of a compromise that if the claimant did a root canal at his own expense, then Dr. Will would finish the job and complete the tooth restoration. So I think there are several questions here. One, whether Mr. Hartnett has any updated information. The medical information in the file or dental information is about a year old. And then I guess there's the question as to whether the subcommittee believes the injury on December 24th of 09 did cause the ongoing problem, in which case the state should be liable. But if the injury is not the proximate cause, is there nevertheless some urgent dental care that would qualify for state payment, I think are the issues. And perhaps Mr. Hartnett has additional information.
Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, the current situation with Mr. Berggren is that he has continued to receive antibiotics and is in essence in a stable situation. He has an abscess that has developed a fistula, which is kind of an encapsulation of it, continues to decline to have dental x-rays, which is part of the reason that his root canal is considered to be risky because they don't have any way of knowing the shape of the tooth, et cetera. To give you the committee kind of a brief overview of how the dental policy at the DOC works, in essence, we have dentists that work for the Department of Corrections, and they are responsible for the dental care for our offenders. If there is a dental problem that requires that it be taken outside of the department, that it is not a non-emergent, in other words, it doesn't affect the individual's physical health, then that is done at the expense of the offender. For example, if someone were wanted braces because their teeth were crooked, that wouldn't happen at the department. We do root canals to some extent at the department. Obviously, those are the ones that are less complex. Generally, the alternative to having a root canal and a complex thing is to either go out and to have that done at the offender's expense or to have that tooth extracted because that can be done in-house. So that's kind of the context in which Mr. Berggren's claim comes forward. When he did, in fact, receive an injury that resulted in a chipped tooth, however, the dental records seem to indicate that that tooth was already had advanced decay and that the need for root canal or the infection he had in his tooth was the result of the decay, not the result of the injury.
So, Mr. Hartnett, to summarize, the department is recommending denial of his claim?
Yes, I would recommend denial or to allow Mr. Berggren to take advantage of the offer that was made by the dentist, which I see as a compromise, which is that if he had the root canal performed outside of the department at his expense, the rest of the restoration, which could be done in-house, would be taken care of by the department.
Very good. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hartnett, so if the offender decided to have an extraction, would that be paid for by DOC?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, yes, it would.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further on this? Any further questions? If not, we're just going to have to lay this case over until we have a quorum, and then we can deal with it. Excuse me, at that time. Ms. Timmons, the next item.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The next case is Donald Bradley. This is a claim for $15,000 for a burn suffered while claimant was working on April 25th, 2009. The subcommittee previously laid this claim over to see if there was a permanent injury. Typically, there's a two-year waiting period for that, and so that waiting period expired on April 25th of 2011. The claimant was discharged from custody October 9th of 2009, and I understand there's been no contact from him. So although the burn area has not been recently viewed, the burn was about a 4-inch by 5-inch burn, and under the guidelines of the workers' comp rating system that we typically use here, the burn would not be rateable as a permanent injury. So my understanding is the DOC recommends denial of this one, and I would concur.
Mr. Hartnett, the department does recommend denial. Do you have any additional comments?
Mr. Chair, no. The basis for denial, we certainly don't deny that Mr. Bradley received a burn. I believe from the medical records indicate that there was appropriate healing to it, but strictly on the basis of Chapter 5223 of the rules, that would not be a rateable injury under those rules, so that's our recommendation.
Any questions from the committee? If not, thank you, and we'll lay that over for the time being. Ms. Timmons, next.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The next claim is Heather Businski. This is a claimant who had a slip and fall on January 26, 2011, while she was on sentence to service in St. Louis County. And she unfortunately suffered a left ankle fracture. So there is a definitive injury, and the DOC recommends that we pay Ms. Businski $3,000 for a 4% permanent injury rating, and also pay $2,268.82 to the medical providers at the medical assistance rates.
Mr. Hartnett, do you want to add anything to your recommendation?
Mr. Chair, the rating in Ms. Brzezinski's case is based on the fact that if you look at where the ankle bone articulates against the foot, there are two small bones here, processes, which in her case, both of those were fractured. They have since healed, but because the bone's fracturing causes a permanent injury, there's a rating for that, and that's what the rating is based on.
Any questions from the committee on the Businski matter?
Mr. Chairman. Either the testifier or the chairman, could you explain to me why we would be using the work comp system rating rather than ordinary negligence, where we would take into consideration comparative fault?
Senator, I think there is an answer. Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I've been doing this on and off for about 17 years, and the first answer would be that's what the subcommittee has always done, or at least for the past 17 years. I suspect that the reason that they adopted the use of the workers' comp disability schedule is because it's comprehensive and because it's probably more appropriate in a non-adversarial system, which this is meant to be. We do not generally recommend denial of a claim if it appears that there was negligence on the part of the claimant. Given the situation where we have offenders that will frequently disobey the rules, for example, not using guards that are in place, etc., also a system where the offenders will tend to always assert that there's been negligence on the department's part, whether or not that is accurate, I think using a non-adversarial system makes the most sense. But I know that it was in place prior to my starting, and I'm assuming that since the injury started, since the statute came into place, they had to use something as a test for what the injuries are, and they used the workers' comp schedule.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions at all? Is there a motion to support the recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we support the recommendation to pay Heather Businski as recommended by the department.
Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Passes. We'll hold the first two over until the end, but let's get on to the next one, the Clark matter, Nathan Clark. Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The next case is the case of Nathan Clark. This is a claim for $6,000 or negotiable, Mr. Clark says, for a laceration to the right hand while at work on December 28, 2009. The day after the injury, claimant had surgery to repair a tendon. That was on December 29th of 09. So there is some permanent range of motion limitation, and that is rated at 1.1% of the body, which equates to $825. So the department is recommending to pay Nathan Clark $825 for this permanent injury.
Mr. Hartnett, do you have anything further to add?
I don't, Mr. Chairman, other than, again, this is a rating that's in Chapter 5223. The ratings related to the fingers are, they will give you a percentage of that particular finger, and then you take that percentage and multiply it against the percentage of the whole body that that finger represents. So that's why we end up with in this case, kind of an unusual percentage of 1.1, because in that case, I think it was 10% of the middle finger, which is an 11% permanency.
Any questions from the committee? If not, is there a motion to support the recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I'll move to support the recommendation.
Very good. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Passes. Next item is the Gassler Robert.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The Robert Gassler claim is for $7,000 for a work injury sustained on January 10th of 2011 when a flying piece of wood punctured the claimant in the abdomen. Medical records show that he received prompt medical attention, surgery, and follow-up care. So with that medical attention, there is the wound healed up well, and there's no evidence in the medical records of a permanent injury. Therefore, the DOC recommends denial, and I would concur.
Mr. Hartnett, anything further on that?
Mr. Chair, just a remark that, as I said, I've been doing this for 17 years, and this is one of the most unusual reasons that someone has gotten injured. In this case, Mr. Gassler was working in industry, and some, I believe, 40 or 50 feet away, someone was working in a saw. A piece of wood got bound between the saw and the gate and was cast forward, and it was sharp enough that it did puncture him in the abdomen. Fortunately, when he was taken to the emergency room, they did exploratory surgery, and he had not injured any of his internal organs. So, consequently, I don't believe there's any permanent injury in this particular case, other than the scar, which, because it's on his abdomen, would not be rateable because it wouldn't meet the size requirements under the workers' comp disability schedule.
Any questions from the committee? Is there a motion? The recommendation is denial of this claim. Any discussion? Is there a motion?
So moved. For denial.
Senator Wigger, thank you. Any discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item is the William Jones matter.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. William Jones is a claim for $6,700 for a slip and fall while at work on May 14th, 2011. The claimant has been seen several times for back pain, but the diagnosis has been for muscle strain. Since there is no evidence of a permanent injury, the DOC recommends denial, and I would concur.
Mr. Hartnett, anything more on that?
Mr. Chair, just to mention for the committee, workers' comp disability schedules about the spine do have a 0% rating to try and deal with some of these complaints that don't really have a physiological basis. And that's where this one comes in. In this particular case, the claimant has continued, or did at least during the period of the time that we collected the medical records here, complained of pain. However, there weren't any physical findings that suggested that there had been any injury. And so consequently, it's not a matter of we didn't go in there and rate it. We went in and looked at it, and what the medical picture looked like resulted in a rating of zero under the disability schedule.
Questions from the committee. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartnett, I did notice that in the letter it said that there's the ability to deny and re-review if something changes in terms of the symptoms. Could you just cover that really quickly for us?
Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that's correct. We do bring back from time to time cases where we actually have one before the subcommittee today related to an individual that was here for his medical and his medical claim a year ago and has returned for a wage loss claim. So typically that would be a decision that would be made by the subcommittee. We generally recommend that if it's appropriate, if it's someone that comes back, for example, and says, I didn't get enough money last time, our recommendation would be don't reopen the case, but ultimately that would be the subcommittee's decision.
Thank you.
So there's nothing to prevent someone from coming back if there are further injuries that can be shown to be as a result of that accident.
Any other questions? Is there a motion to support the department denying the claim?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the claim be denied.
Very good. Senator, any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next item is the Mario Muck matter.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I believe this is Mary Jo Muck is the name of the claimant. And it's a claim for $7,000 for an injury sustained while at work, lifting a large box or bucket of apples on October 29th, 2010. Ms. Muck said that she felt her left shoulder go pop. And indeed, after the work injury, she had left rotator cuff surgery on November 10th of 2010 to repair that left rotator cuff. It should be noted, however, that in medical records, a medical history taken in 2006, Ms. Muck had reported to a medical provider that she had previously had left rotator cuff surgery on that same area. So at the current time, it does appear that she has some movement restrictions that appear permanent. And the DOC is saying that there are a couple different options here. One would be to lay the claim over, to wait a little bit longer for the typical two-year period of maximum medical improvement. Since the injury was just on October 29th of 2010, the 2 years would occur this fall. Or we could pay $2,400 now for the permanent injury, which was Mr. Hartnett figured at a 6% rating for the left rotator cuff problems, but cutting the $4,800 in half to attribute 50% to the prior injury to the left rotator cuff and 50% to the work injury. So those are a couple of options that the committee could entertain.
Mr. Hartnett, you've heard summary and do you have anything further to add?
Well, I would just like to explain for the subcommittee a little bit about my recommendation. Approximately 3 months before Ms. Muck's injury occurred, the subcommittee that recommends updating of the disability schedules changed the rating for a rotator cuff from what we used to call a surgical rating, which meant if you had surgery on that part, you had that permanency, to a rating based on what the level range of motion is. in Ms. Muck's case, she does have a range of motion limitation. The physical therapist believes that it will improve maybe to the point of completely going away. What complicates this case is Ms. Muck had pre-existing a lot of problems with her shoulder and neck area. She has a spinal cord, I'm trying to describe it for you, but it's something she was born with, a hollow space in her spinal cord, which as a result of that, part of her brain is protruding into her spinal cord, and obviously that affects the nerves here. My concern was that once she got out of prison, having all these medical concerns, that physical therapy might fall by the way. I don't know. So I don't know where she is going to be 2 years from now. Had she been injured 3 months earlier, she would have gotten the surgical rating. What I'm recommending to the subcommittee that they can consider is to rate it at that surgical rating, which means that we'd be able to rate it right now, and she would have permanency she would be paid for that permanency at this point, and then going forward, whether or not she had improvement in that range of motion, she would have been covered.
Questions from the committee. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartnett, I can't recall from the record, but was the department on notice of this pre-existing condition? I don't think so. I thought that it was only once she injured or re-injured her rotator cuff, then it came out that she had the pre-existing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't recall, to tell you the truth. I know that it was a pre-existing a birth defect, if you will. I know that she has had neurosurgery since she's been in prison. That would have been related to her spinal issue. As far as the prior rotator cuff, we did not have notice of that. That came as part of one of the records that we got related to her. We received a medical history related to her brain injury that said she had previously had a rotator cuff, but did not say how long ago it was or where it had taken place.
So, Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, is that the reason that you applied a 50%? You applied 50% to the 6% rating, the 4,800. Is that how you got the 2,400?
Yes.
Kind of okay.
Yeah, because of the prior rotator cuff.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Simon.
You mentioned something I just didn't follow about 2 years. Is there some sort of limitations period
Mr.
here?
No. The 2 years limitation applies only to burn injuries. Generally, when we're rating something, we rate it at the point of maximum medical improvement. That's a medical determination. Sometimes it'll be less than 2 years. Sometimes it'll be longer. But it's when there's a medical appointment that the person is not likely to, a medical opinion that the person is not likely to get better. And it's at that point that you rate permanency. As it, you know, for example, if I were to twist my ankle today, tomorrow I would be hobbling around on a cane or a crutch. 6 months from now, I would probably not have a permanent injury. So the permanent injury would be measured at the point where I had gone through therapy and through the healing process and was not likely to get any better. In this particular case, The disability schedule had what was called a surgical rating, which meant that once you had surgery on that rotator cuff, that's when it would be rated. Okay, you wouldn't wait for a healing period other than it's just that if you had surgery on a full tear rotator cuff, that's what the rating would be. As far as the 50%, I will concede that that's conjectural because that's trying to apportion one rotator cuff and another rotator cuff to surgery, which may well have only taken place once.
Senator Millman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned the prior rotator cuff. You also mentioned that she had some spinal cord problems in her neck. Did you inquire, and do you have any idea as to how many, if any, prior claims she has made either under work comp or in district court actions?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, I did not.
Any other questions? We have recommendations in the alternative, either postpone consideration until fall or a payment of $2,400 today. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Simon.
I move that we, assuming that we have other matters on the agenda, I move postponement to see if this thing heals up. It just seems to me, I mean, I'm not no expert in rotator cuff injuries, but it seems to me that we don't have to pay today. Hopefully, she will have some improvement, and then it's a win-win, I suppose. So
I'll be my motion. The chair will accept that as a motion to lay on the table. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Matter's laid over. The next is Greg Brzezinski.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, the Greg Brzezinski case is a sentence to service case. Mr. Brzezinski was doing STS in Morrison County on March 14th of 2011, and he was hit by a pine tree. He was knocked unconscious, taken by ambulance to the hospital, but very fortunately does not appear to have sustained permanent injuries. The DOC does recommend payment of $1,295.48 to medical providers at the MA rates.
Any questions of Mr. Hartnett from the committee? Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Who went first? Senator Newman moves payment of the claim of $1,295.48. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next item is the Chad Westring claim.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Chad Westring was also injured by a tree on April 6, 2009, while on sentence to service in Todd County. The subcommittee previously approved payment to Mr. Westring of $11,475 for permanent injuries and $13,903.33 to medical providers. This was in the 2010, I believe, claims bill. Now, Mr. Westring's claim is for wage loss. And Mr. Hartnett has explained to me and can explain to the subcommittee that wage loss has been paid in previous cases where it's been proven. But there are three categories of wage loss here, and the DOC recommends payment of the first two categories but express concerns about the third category, which I believe if there is a letter that that Jackie Dutcher, the claims clerk, passed out that has kind of a black band across the top that I believe says the category number three has been withdrawn by Mr. Westring's attorney. So the two categories that are still claimed and that I believe the department is in agreement with, category one is for May 1st, 2009 to July 11th, 2009, the 10 weeks when the doctors prohibited Mr. Westring from working after this tree injury that he sustained. And so that is a total of $7,014.30. His weekly wage of $701.43 times 10 weeks. Category 2 is the time period from July 11th, 2009 to October 24th, 2009, during which Mr. Westring was getting unemployment compensation. And so that claim is figured as the 701.43 weekly wage minus $351 weekly unemployment times 15 weeks, and that adds up to $5,256.45. So I believe, if I've done my math right, these two categories add up to $12,270.75. I guess it says 76 cents in the claimant's. the attorney's letter.
Yeah.
Any questions from the committee of Mr. Hartnett? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartnett, under the DOC recommendations on our in our packet, it said you recommend paying out that $12,270 in whatever sense. Just my question is, are we on so-called safe ground? We're not setting any precedent here. It goes back and equals what we've done in the past.
Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, in general, yes, it does. I will have to say that given the clientele that we have, even in our sentence to serve program, we haven't had a lot of wage loss claims. Offenders that are in prison don't have a claim for wage loss. They are, because that's the way it works in prison. So when we do have a wage loss claim, it comes from a sentence to serve case where we have somebody who was employed prior to their being arrested and having to work on sentence to serve. In this particular case, Mr. Westring's original claim included a period of time that he was collecting unemployment during a seasonal layoff. The year prior to that, he simply collected the unemployment, and it was my belief that it ought not to be the taxpayer's liability to supplement that, given his history of not working during the off season. So that was my recommendation, and Mr. Johnson, his counsel, conceded that he actually showed up here on Friday for the original subcommittee meeting, and then when he found out it had been canceled, he contacted me and said that he agreed with that and asked that I present it in hopes that the subcommittee would follow my recommendation on the other two categories of wage loss, and that would be my recommendation.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartnett, you satisfied me on that one. In terms of the original injury, was there some safety rules on the site that weren't followed? And if I'm concerned about this kind of thing happening again on a sentence-to-serve type of...
I understand, Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer. This was a very unusual injury in that our STS crews will do lots of work. Generally, it's in the outdoor arena, parks, cleanup, that sort of thing. In this particular case, a tree fell on him. I believe, if memory serves, he was wearing safety equipment. He just happened to be in the wrong place at the time that the tree fell. And suffered a fairly serious injury in that he fractured two of the vertebrae in his neck. So that was the result. As a result of that, his permanency rating was actually fairly high in comparison to other permanency ratings. Probably in the 17 years that I've been doing this, we've had half a dozen cases that are at that level of seriousness. I don't know that there was any safety violation that I can recall on this. It's, you know, one of the problems is that there are some jobs that simply have an element of risk with them.
Any other questions?
No.
If not, Senator Wieger. I'm sorry. Were you done?
Senator Jungbauer?
If there's no other questions, I was going to move it. But if...
Well, Mr. Chair, I won't dwell on it too much, but... I assume that when people are using chainsaws, they've had some previous experience, and you know, for a tree to go down the wrong way, it usually just doesn't happen. And you know, if you cut it, unless there's extraordinary wind or something, you know, it just seems kind of bizarre. Like the person doesn't know what they're doing. And it questioned me as to whether you know, there was any training or what's done before. To make sure, you know, a chainsaw is dangerous, and you know, maybe they have the goggles and all that. I'm not sure if you just happen to be around there, but it's you know, there should be protocols. You know, and trees going down and people the heads up.
Mr. Hartnett, proceed with your answer and let us know what the procedures you have, if any, for training in the use of a chainsaw, and if there are, what training did he get? If you know, go ahead and answer that. Senator's question.
Sure. Senator, Ron Solide is the individual in our office that manages those programs. He has actually spoken before the subcommittee in the past and does have written presentation related to chainsaw safety training and kind of the use of chainsaws and other for wood cutting. They do wood splitting, that sort of thing. I can certainly ask Mr. Soli to prepare that and forward it to the members. But yes, our STS program prides itself on having good training related to chainsaws. As a matter of fact, I believe when this case came up last year, members of the subcommittee asked the same question.
Senator Jimbar, or Weger, do you have anything further?
Mr. Chair, I would like to see that memo, and I'm just curious if we have many claims from DNR employees or MnDOT employees that do this, who presumably are trained. And you know, I appreciate what's done on these crews, but you could potentially have a huge claim involving chainsaw. And
is there a motion, Senator Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair, I move that recommend or as to pay the recommended amount from the DOC on the Chad Westring
discussion
item.
Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Last item under injury claims, William Williams matter. Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. William Williams has brought a claim for $6,925 for lacerations to two fingers and the thumb on his right hand. The injury occurred October 21st, 2010, when using a chainsaw on STS in Becker County. There is some loss of flexion of the right thumb, rated as a 1.32% permanent injury. The DOC recommends payment of $990, and I concur. Payment, okay. Yes.
Any questions of Mr. Hartnett from the committee on this claim of $990, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just make a comment. In looking at this, it appears that he manually applied the chain break. I will tell you that I have spent I don't know how many hours behind a chainsaw. I mean, maybe thousands, hundreds for sure. I have never manually applied a chain break. So I don't know what this guy was doing.
Other questions or comments? Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hartnett, as I was looking through that, it on our last page anyway, it says Dr. Soule's opinion that any loss of range of motion was related to inactivity, and the claimant did not return to PT after July. Is there any other updates on that,
Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, no, there are not. Williams was actually a prisoner at the time that this injury occurred. He was working in the ICWIC program, which is a program where low-risk offenders that are near their release date are taken out on crews and then spend their evenings at the county jail as a way to kind of reintegrate them into the community. So one of the reasons that you'll notice he requested $6,900 is we find that a lot with prisoner claims because the statute permits the wardens of prisons to settle claims for $7,000. So a lot of times we find requests that are just less than $7,000. The rating that I recommended here is a rating that was in place at the last time he was seen by a physical therapist while he was in prison. He has now been released, and we haven't heard from him. So I guess the benefit of the doubt is to make that recommendation. Were we to ask him to come in to see a doctor to have an independent medical exam, that would cost about $1,700. And it seems to make more sense to give him the rating that was last at the last time that we had a chance to do it than to throw good money after bad, if you will.
Is there a motion? Last call. Is there a motion? All right. Let's move along to property claims. Mr. Hartnett and Michelle, let's proceed.
Mr. Chairman, did you want to go back and get the minutes approved?
We'll revert to consideration of the minutes. They're in the packet. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Senator Jungbauer moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those no, minutes are adopted.
Let's approve this medical reimbursement that I presented.
Which one? Under item 3.
The 86162.
Okay, we do have three items that we should go back to.
Right.
Ms. Timmons, what's that first
one? Yes, the first one, which I did present before the quorum, before we got a quorum, is the medical reimbursement for the several injury claims under $500 for a two-month period, January 14th through March 14th, and that's a total of $861.62.
I would move to pay the medical reimbursement injury claim for the department.
There's a motion before us from Senator Jungbauer. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Let's go back to items 1 and 2 under claims. Ed Berggren, Donald Bradley. Just Ms. Timmons, we don't need to summarize everything over again. Just give us the amount in a few seconds.
Exactly. The Edward Berggren claim is the one that's for $5,000 or the total tooth repair. And this is the one where the dentist says the problem is caused by tooth decay and not by the accident.
There's a recommendation from the DOC for denial. Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Wardlow. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The claim is denied. The last item that we should go back to is Donald Bradley case?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Donald Bradley is a claim for $15,000. It had to do with a burn that, and this was laid over by a previous subcommittee to see if there was a permanent injury. The two-year waiting period has now expired, and there does not appear to be a permanent injury. So the DOC recommends denial.
Is there a motion for denial? Senator Jungbaum moves denial of the claim. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. I think now we can proceed to the property claims. We do have 19 of those, so we need to pick up the pace a little bit if we can. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, there were only three of these that I thought warranted some discussion. And maybe subcommittee members have others, but the three that I thought the committee would want to discuss is number 14, the David Collier claim, number 25, the Jonathan Model claim, and the third is number 28, Larry Propotnick.
Let's proceed with the Collier matter.
Okay.
First of all, offhand, does anyone on the committee see any additional items you want to hear and discuss? We will briefly go through each one because we're going to individually at least pass the ones that we were talking about.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
The number 13 was, I was curious about in reading that one. I had some questions. So other than that, I agreed with Ms. Timmons on which ones to hear.
Okay. Any other committee member wanting an additional item to have some time here? Ms. Timmons, why don't we go through 13, 14, 25, and 28?
Okay. 13 is the Adolphus Brown case. And Mr. Brown left the Faribault Correctional Facility at Faribault on January 22, 2011 on a writ. And he says that he received money at the, so he went to the county, and he says he received money there from Faribault, and was told when he left Faribault that his property would follow within a month and the cost of shipping the property would be deducted from his account. The property never did arrive, but the claimant says his lawyer called about it, but the DOC staff said nobody contacted them. On June 15th, 2011, the claimant was incarcerated again and went to the St. Cloud Correctional Facility. He then found out that all his property had been destroyed. And I wrote on the back sheet here, while the DOC has no clear record of the property destruction, the DOC apparently destroyed the property according to the policy that property is destroyed after 90 days without a contact. The claim did seem plausible, and the $500 amount was fairly reasonable for the value of all his property. At least it was in the ballpark. But the DOC action was also reasonable in light of their side of the story that there was no contact from him for 5.5 months. And so it was one I actually struggled with a little bit, but on balance recommended denial. But Ms. Lind is here and can speak more about the claim.
Well, let's, any questions? Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Lind, I guess, as well, Ms. Timmons, when I read through it, and I've been pretty clear about missing record, so to speak, and there was no clear record of the, you know, that the property was destroyed and things, and there was just some other things in there that caused me to write in my notes that I'd be inclined to pay something. So I try to read through all these things, and if there's missing pieces or something just doesn't make sense to me, I tend to side a little more in favor with the claimant, I guess.
Do you have a motion?
I guess, Mr. Chair and members, I would move to pay $250. $500 was the probable value, but in light of missing records and that the claimant says he actually tried to file something sooner than that 5.5 months, that would be my recommendation.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Timmons.
Yes, just procedurally, I believe on these property claims, the typical action on the part of the committee is to direct the DOC to pay the $250. I don't believe we'd be putting this in the actual claims bill, as we would the injury and medical provider amounts you've already approved today.
So that direction can come by motion?
Yes.
From us?
Yes.
So that would be
Senator
my...
Senator Jungbauer, you want to amend your motion?
That would be my amended motion to direct DOC to pay $250 in light of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we can...
your name and position.
We can ask Karen McHale.
Your name and position, please.
But
ma'am, your name and position. Sorry.
For the record.
For the record.
Ms. Nicole Lynn, DLC Property Claims Officer. Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we could ask him to accept the $250, but he could deny that and come back and request the full $500. So,
thank you, Ms. Linden. I would amend my motion further to allow the DOC to make an offer of $250 to settle this case.
That motion is before us. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
It appears that to the chair that the motion does pass. All right, let's move on to David Callier issue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. David Collier is a claim for $5,000 for two pieces of artwork. The claimant says he's a professional artist, and each piece would actually have sold for $6,000, and he had a detailed explanation about how he would make 500 prints of each piece and in different kinds of formats to add up to $6,000 each. Now, in this claim, the staff admit that the drawings were in his cell and removed from the cell with the rest of his property, but then property staff were unable to find them. So there doesn't seem to be an issue of liability here. It seems as if the DOC is admitting that there was some staff negligence here, and in fact offered Mr. Collier $100 And they valued the pieces of artwork at $100 because DLC policy is that offenders can have a maximum value of $100 in hobby or craft items. Mr. Collier refused, and then I believe Ms. Lind indicated via email to me that the DLC had reoffered the $100 a second time in advance of this subcommittee meeting, and it was refused a second time. I think the options are to either deny the claim or direct the DLC to make a higher offer, as the issue appears to be one of valuation of the artwork.
Mr. Hartnett, I'm reading from this booklet that says that the DOC policy says, quote, total value of hobby or craft items cannot exceed $100. Is that a written Department of Corrections policy?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
And where is that written directive contained? Is it in a handbook?
There is a valuation for property that is presented to every offender as they come in.
So he was on notice when he came in that craft or hobby items of which you suggest this fits has a maximum value of $100.
Correct. The difficulty, of course, Mr. Chair, is that we will have claims from offenders, for example, that we had one claim in the past where an offender had a printed photograph that came off of a computer, and he said that was the only photograph of one of the members of his family. It was somehow lost during the process. By explanation, we have 10,000 prisoners. We have hundreds of thousands of property transactions every year. Things do get lost. It's just part of that process. When things do get lost, and the subcommittee should be aware that we pay a number of claims that never come here because we've paid them before they come here. But we get an issue of valuation. We have somebody, for example, that says in this particular case, this is my artwork, which is worth this much because of some event that's going to happen in the future. Obviously, we don't have any control over that, so we give them notice that this is how much it's worth. Things like watches. We've got, I think it's a $20 limit. That's to prevent the person from coming in and saying, I had a Rolex watch that was worth $6,000. We have no way of knowing if that was a Rolex watch or if it was a fake Rolex watch or if there was no watch to begin with. So that's why we say if you have property that is of a high value, don't bring it to prison.
Is there a motion?
So moved. To deny.
To deny. Discussion on the motion to deny. Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Next item we're going to talk about is item 25, Jonathan Model.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a claim for $130 that the claimant's account was charged for state-issued clothing he had in his possession that was cut or altered. Now, the claimant says he didn't have the altered clothing or he didn't alter it, and is asking why his account was charged without some sort of hearing or form of due process. The charges do appear to be consistent with DOC policy, so I did recommend denial, and that seems appropriate. But in my years of observing the claims committee, now I guess it's three or four, this is the first one that's come through where the claimant has actually been charged for destroying state property, and I thought the subcommittee might want to have some testimony or discussion about the procedures here.
Mr. Hartnett, do you have anything to add to claim 130? You're recommending denial?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have anything to add. I think that Ms. Lynn's recommendation is appropriate in this case. It's not a common thing to have someone come in and make a claim for these deductions related to destruction of state property. But in this particular case, in essence, if someone comes in and they don't have clothes to wear and they don't have the funds to purchase clothes through the various vendors that we have, they get issued these clothes. They're not supposed to destroy them. In this particular case, it's my understanding that this offender made cutoffs out of the jeans and did some other sorts of alterations. We don't allow offenders to have altered property in their possession. During the course of a shakedown, corrections officers found this. It was altered. It was removed. It belonged to the state, so his account was charged. We get lots and lots and lots of altered property found in the cells. I think what Mr. Lyons from the facility is saying, that if we had to have a discipline hearing every time we found altered property, it would bog down the system because there's a lot of altered property there.
Any questions, Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hartnett, so the property that was altered belonged to the state and not to the offender?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that's correct.
Okay, and then I would move that we deny the claim.
If there's no other questions of the witness, there's a motion before us to deny. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Claim is denied. Next, item 28, Larry Propotnick.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, this is a claim for $11,458.87 for a variety of items, the vast majority of which there appeared to be no evidence of negligence on the part of the DOC staff. But with respect to Mr. Propotnick's television, the DOC admits that property staff accidentally did damage it. Apparently it was on a counter in the property room, and the sergeant's feet got tangled up in the cord and down the TV went to the floor. And so the DOC has already offered Mr. Propotnick $224.70, which he refused. And so I thought, in light of the admission of liability, that we should direct the DOC to reoffer the $224.70.
Any questions from the committee on this? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. I'll move authorization for the department to offer $224.70 for the...
Isn't that done?
Motion.
And to deny the rest of the claim.
And to deny the rest of the claim. Okay. Ms. Timmons, do you have that motion?
I do.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would move that all the remaining items we haven't dealt with under item B, property claims, having looked at those all, I would move that we deny all the further claims as one motion.
There's a motion to deny the balance of claims. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Ms. Timmons, what's next?
I believe the next item on the agenda should actually be 4C,
right.
Is request for reconsideration of the Audie Fox claim 11-PR001. This was a claim that was denied by the subcommittee on April 15th, 2011. Mr. Fox then contacted our claims clerk, Jackie Dutcher, and he called her, I believe, several times, wrote to her. I then wrote a letter explaining that the committee had considered the claim and denied it, and reiterated some of the reasons why the DOC recommended denial. There was actually a videotape at one point that showed other offenders reaching through the bars to grab a number of canteen items that were stored near the door, the cell door. In any event, Mr. Fox then wrote back asking for reconsideration of his claim. And the one other thing I wanted to call to your attention, as I was reviewing the subcommittee rules of procedure, the rule of procedure number 13, the last one, says a claim that has been previously heard and denied by the subcommittee shall not be reconsidered unless the claimant presents newly discovered evidence that by due diligence could not have been discovered in time for the earlier hearing, or unless there are other similar unusual circumstances.
Ms. Timmons, has he produced any such new evidence?
In my opinion, no.
Mr. Chair?
Questions from the committee. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In reading the response that Mr. Fox sent to myself, and I don't know if all the subcommittee had it, I believe that some information didn't seem to get into our original packet, at least if it was there. I certainly didn't notice it. About one of the things I had read was from the Fox situation was we were told by DOC that everything had to be in locked, certain specified locked storage, and Mr. Fox contends that it was actually in that storage, but somehow you could get into that storage with a cane, and that everything was videotaped, and there was evidence on videotape that these folks had taken his property, and that as well nobody was charged with any crime of theft or anything with that. So I guess I didn't see that particular information in our original packet that about the kind of storage and that he could get in there. So I guess from DOC, I would like some more information on his contention that it was actually secured the way it was supposed to be and it was still able to be removed.
Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we provide two tubs of for storage of personal property, and those can be secured. It differs depending on the facility, but in some facilities there's a metal slide-in thing that can be locked to prevent people, particularly cellmates, from going into personal property. Mr. Fox had 9 tubs worth of canteen in his cell. So if there were things in tubs, it was because he had so much additional canteen that it came out to the edge of the cell where people were able to reach in and pull things out. So it would have been secured had it been within the limits, but in his case, it was more than what was in the limits. Senator Jungbauer, with your leave, I'll speak to the videotape, which I will concede I haven't viewed, but talked to the claims officer at the facility. Typically, in a case where we would have videotape evidence or officer would see an offender stealing from another offender, they would in fact be disciplined for that. In this particular case, the video showed a long line of offenders apparently going out to chow or to some other thing, and individuals were not recognizable within that, and it was a matter of Mr. Fox's having things right next to the bars in his cell so that people could simply reach in, or in this particular case, I guess they said somebody had pulled in with a stick or a cane or something like that. Had his things been within that sliding in area, they would not have been able to access it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, in the back of the packet, there is a note from State of Minnesota indicating that Mr. Fox has previously filed 21 lawsuits against the DOC since 1995 and has no doubt cost the DOC thousands of dollars in staff time alone with his frivolous filings. In this particular case, it appears he filed a claim in conciliation court that was removed to the district court. The district court dismissed the claim, and he allowed his time to appeal to expire. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we deny the reconsideration of Mr. Fox's claim.
Are you sure? Before discussion on the motion, Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And again, the reason I wanted to relook at this was understanding Mr. Fox had said a cane was used, and it just there were these circumstances, and I realize Mr. Fox has had many previous things, but there did seem to be some merit in my mind to this as to how can somebody be having a cane to get it close enough to be able to. So I don't know what incarcerated folks can have, but he says that it was a cane that reached in and got it close enough. So it just seemed to have some merit in terms of somebody should have been, if they were that far away that you had to use a cane, one would assume that no matter what Mr. Fox's past had been, that you as a inmate could assume some security for your items if they were that far in the cell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, this is completely conjectural on my part because I didn't review the circumstances of this other than what were presented here. But I assume that there are offenders who have canes because they're medically required. Whether that was the case here or not, I don't know. And again, as I said, I did not view the video.
Any further discussion on the Newman motion to deny? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Ms. Simmons, what's next?
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe the next we're on to agenda item Roman numeral 5, claims against Minnesota Department of Revenue. And this is the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District claim.
Under the red.
I believe that's more towards the front of your packet. This is a claim brought by the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District in the amount of $9,200. This total represents fees charged to landowners between November of 2009 and April 15th of 2011 for conservation assessment plans that were necessary at that time to get the favorable Green Acres tax treatment. A change in the law was made by Minnesota Laws 2011 Chapter 13, and that effectively eliminated the conservation assessment plan requirement on April 16th of 2011. At the November meeting of the subcommittee, I was requested to do a memo and answer a number of questions to provide the subcommittee members with the 2009 and 2011 versions of the Minnesota statutes, section 273.114. So my memo is dated December 28th, is in your packet along with those statutes. There were a couple of other questions that I was asked. One was, did the law require, the 2009 law, did it require to approve the plans or to prepare the plans? And the statutory language is to approve the conservation assessment plans. And another question from, I believe, Senator Newman was whether the statute addressed the issue of fees. And it does not. It's silent on that question. So so the Soil and Water Conservation was not district was not required to charge a fee, I don't believe, but not prohibited from doing so either. I was also asked whether any other claims were similarly situated, and I called Mr. Patrick Finnegan from the Department of Revenue, who I believe is here, to testify, and at that time in December, he told me he was not aware of any. He's here to testify to see if there's any update in that. And then the third thing that the subcommittee asked me at the November meeting was whether I recalled any claims in the past that were of a similar nature. And so I did do a brief synopsis of another claim that certainly is not on all 4 points with this claim, but had a similar consideration of a change in the law costing somebody money, and it was a claim called Total Auto Solutions against the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services Division. That claim was heard and denied on March 26th of 2010. And what had happened is that the law was changed to require greater disclosure on titles for used motor vehicles so that adverse events like hail damage, fires, accidents, and so forth would need to be more fully disclosed as of a date and time. And the claimant was somebody who had purchased a whole fleet of damaged used vehicles before the change in the law, when the titles were more clean than they were after the date of the law that went into effect. And his claim was that due to the change in the law, the value of the used cars had gone down, and so that he asked for money damages for that. And the minutes for the subcommittee typically do not reflect reasoning, but the conversation I recall at the time was a concern about that there are many changes in the law that may have an economic impact, and what would be the precedent of paying that. So that is the one that I could recall over the past 3 to 4 years that was most similar. So,
well, Ms. Timmons, the recommendation from the DOC says that the Department of Revenue pointed out or confirmed that none of the collected fees were deposited in the state treasury. So that means that Sherburne County collected and kept the sum of money we're talking about. Is that correct?
I believe they paid Who's back that? Part of the money to the landowners, some portion of it, but I believe they are here to testify.
Who's at the table? Identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm Bill Bronder with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation
District. Speak up.
I'm Bill Bronder with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm the interim manager, and with me is Francine Larson. She is the office manager for the district. And I guess, I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Well, first of all, testify as to whatever you want to on this case, but my question is that it would appear from the DOC recommendation to deny that Sherburne County collected several thousand dollars in fees, and none of that money was collected. Strike that. None of the fees collected were deposited with the state, so the state hasn't seen any of the money Sherburne County has in its entirety. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. But what our claim is based on is that, if you recall, the Rural Preserves Property Tax Program was enacted originally in 2009 in response to changes in 2008 to the Green Acres Program. And the purpose of the Rural Property Tax Program, it was meant to provide similar tax benefits to that portion of the farm that was not actively cropped. And even though the changes were passed in 2009, or the original Rural Preserve Property Tax Program was passed in 2009, it wasn't until 2010 that we received the details of how a landowner could enroll into the Rural Preserve Property Tax Program. And we were asked to assist let's back up here a little bit. So landowners had to decide by May 1st of 2010, which was only a couple of months, to whether or not to stay in the Green Acres Program, withdraw from the Green Acres Program, or to transition to the Rural Preserves Program in order to avoid penalties for withdrawal later on. Well, to assist the landowners in making that decision, whether to withdraw by May 1st, the Soil and Water Conservation District was requested not only by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Department of Revenue, but also the Sherburne County's Assessor's Office, because there, just in Sherburne County alone, there was more than 1,100 parcels that could potentially have entered into the Rural Preserves Program. And we were only talking a couple of months that we had to get the information out to the landowners so they could make a decision on whether or not they wanted to enroll into the program. So we spent considerable amount of district resources on notifying the landowners, public meetings. We attended all of the town board meetings in the county to inform the board supervisors, and we also published quite a few articles in the three local newspapers, and all in an effort to get that information out there so that the landowner could make a proper decision as to whether or not to withdraw from Green Acres, whether to enroll into the rural preserves, or whether to just get out of the whole thing. Unfortunately, as it turns out, in this process, all of this activity did result in landowners enrolling into the rural preserves in Sherburne County, actually 32 landowners. They did complete the transition, which meant we provided or assisted them with developing their conservation assessment plan. We assisted them with filling out the covenant forms, and they actually recorded the covenants. This was done in 2010, and then in 2011, the legislature decided that they no longer had to do all of that. They no longer had to have a conservation assessment plan. They no longer had to have a covenant. But 32 landowners in Sherburne County had done the transition, and now it turns out that it wasn't needed, that they no longer needed to do it. And so our contention is, yes, we did charge the landowners for those conservation assessment plans, to prepare the conservation assessment plans. We charged them to prepare the covenants and help them get those documents recorded. Normally, a soil and water conservation district does not charge for natural resource conservation assistance that it provides to landowners. But we view that the Rural Preserve Property Tax Program and the effort that we were being asked to do was a tax program. And because of that, we did charge a fee. And the fee amounted to $325 per landowner. And that pretty much just covered the cost of doing the conservation assessment plan and the enrollment and the covenants. It didn't include or doesn't include any of the charges or any of the effort that the district put into developing this program, into contacting the landowners and getting them ready to make that transition. And unfortunately, like I said, we did too good of a job, because we enrolled 32 landowners, made that transition, and then the legislature decided that they no longer needed to do that. So what we're requesting is the reimbursement for the cost of doing the conservation assessment plans and the covenants, and then it's our intention to reimburse the landowners for those fees. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, to the testifiers, thank you for coming here and talking about your claim. I mean, I admire your persistence, but apart from the fact that this isn't money that was deposited with the state, that the state somehow owes, I guess my other concern, Mr. Chair, is, you know, I think many legislators of both parties here have really focused in the last year or so on speeding up, streamlining, reforming certain government processes. And this sounds like an example where a certain step that we used to require, we don't require anymore, which I think is very often a good thing. And so I'd hate to think that as a result in the future of us streamlining and simplifying government procedures, that some organ of government out there who once had to do something and now doesn't have to do something would somehow have a claim against us. I'm not an expert on Green Acres, but what I'm hearing you say is that we took away a step. We sort of streamlined things, and then as a result of someone not having to do something, suddenly the state is on the hook for that. And I'm just a little bit worried about the unintended consequences going forward.
Thank you, Representative Simon. So do I have the same concern. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I guess we can view a lot of things as unfunded mandates from the state, but further, I'm reading in the 2009 statute, it said the Board of Water and Soil Resources shall develop and distribute guidance for these plans and the approval process, and nowhere did we actually mandate that you had to get involved that I can find in the statute other than developing that guidance. So once again, looking at the statute, what you ended up doing for folks might have been a great thing, but the state itself did not gain a benefit. So it's hard to then say that the state is responsible for paying back money from changing of that statute.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, could I?
Did you have comment to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Senator Jungbauer. The state, the requirements stated that in order to transition into the Rural Preserves Program, they had to have a conservation assessment plan approved by the local soil and water conservation district. So we did have to provide that assistance.
Sir, I forgot your name. Could you restate full name?
My name is Bill Bronder. I'm the interim manager for the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation.
And spell your last name.
B as in boy, R-O-N, D as in dog, E-R.
Yeah. Does Department of Revenue, are they here, and do you have anything to add? And I guess the question is, any fees collected by Sherburne County were not deposited with the state. Is that correct? Step forward, please, at the table.
Mr. Chair, my name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney in the Revenue Department, and Lance Streak is here also. He's a property tax attorney. I don't think there's a real dispute as far as the law. Ms. Timmons explained the law, and I think she did a good job at that. Basically, we're talking about a change that was made in the legislature. Conservation assessment plans were required under the law, and the law has changed to eliminate that requirement. Not all counties or all districts prepared the plans, for sure. So sometimes they were prepared by private parties, and the fees were, in our position, we're never filed with the department, so we don't believe that we ever receive the fees at all. We have some concerns that there could be precedent set here that if we were mandated to return fees that were never collected here, that possibly other counties or other private preparers of these plans might seek some type of reimbursement for it, but
very good.
We never received the fees, if that's your question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Is there a motion on the claim?
Mr. Chairman, I would move to deny the claim.
Any discussion on the motion to deny claim? Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Ms. Timmons, what's next?
All right. Mr. Chairman and members, Roman numeral 6 on the agenda consists of the claims against the state court administrator, the first of which is a claim from a Lester Bates. Mr. Bates claims an undetermined amount of money for sentences on 3 felony convictions that he claims were incorrectly calculated under the sentencing guidelines based on 2 Illinois juvenile convictions. And first of all, to explain to you why this case is here, I think you need to know something about the case of William Hines that was heard by the subcommittee. This was a claimant who was paid in the 2010 claims bill, Mr. Hines, for a very clear mistake under the sentencing guidelines. Mr. Hines had been convicted of fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle and driving while impaired, and based on prior convictions and so forth, was sentenced to a consecutive sentence of 25 months. Mr. Hines was represented by the state public defender, who appealed the case to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on the merits. In the respondent's brief, the prosecutor, who, as you know, is an officer of the court and duty-bound to point out things that need pointing out, wrote a footnote that I just want to read to you because it's pretty compelling. She puts in her footnote, however, in sentencing appellant to a permissive consecutive sentence of 25 months for count one, fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle, the trial court neglected to use a criminal history score of zero as required by Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Section 2F. Section 2F, permissive consecutive sentences, provides that consecutive sentences are permissive in cases involving a felony conviction for fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle as defined in Minnesota Statute 609.487 and are not a departure. However, the section goes on to provide that for each offense sentenced consecutive to another offense other than those that are presumptive, a zero criminal history score or the mandatory minimum for the offense, whichever is greater, shall be used in determining the presumptive duration. Using a criminal history score of zero, appellant's consecutive sentence for fleeing a peace officer in a motor vehicle, a severity level one offense, would properly be 1 year plus 1 day. So what happened in this previous case is the prosecutor said in her brief, the trial judge made a clear mistake in implementing the sentencing guidelines in this case. The public defender then wrote a reply brief saying, gee, I agree with that. We still want to appeal the case on the merits, but we agree that the sentence was miscalculated. And these briefs flew back and forth in the June of 2007 time period. So then in March 25th of 2008, the Court of Appeals in this Hines case affirmed the conviction but agreed that the sentence had been calculated erroneously. So by the time that particular case was decided, Mr. Hines had been in prison 389 days too long. And the subcommittee compensated him at the rate of $50 per day for each of those 389 days, which was $19,450, and they also compensated him for documented wage loss. And he had very good evidence of wage loss. So the total payment to Mr. Hines was $34,049.10. And I think it's likely because of the Hines case that we now have the Bates case coming and saying there was an error in how he was sentenced. When you read through the Bates record, I thought that there were significant factual differences between the clear error and the extraordinary time frame that it took to correct that error versus what happened in the Bates case, because the issue here is what is the proper weight for juvenile offenses that were committed in the state of Illinois, and they were originally given weights of 1 and 1.5 respectively. And those weights were used for sentences in 2001, 2002, and 2005. Then the weight of the juvenile offenses was first raised in 2009 in a fourth case. But unlike Hines, where all parties agreed there was a mistake, the state, even in 2009, was arguing that the juvenile offenses were actually properly weighted from the get-go. And when you read Judge Bush's memorandum, he says, well, you know, first of all, you have to try to figure out what Illinois, what Minnesota offenses are similar to the Illinois offenses. Then, under the guidelines, if the defendant was 16, that's one factor that has to be considered as to whether or not an adult-like weight would be given to those offenses, and the defendant was 16. But under Minnesota law, the first of those offenses was a robbery. And as I understand Judge Bush's memo, if the robbery was a simple robbery with no weapon, then it would not have been deemed to be certified as an adult. Therefore, the adult weight would not be correct. The zero weight would be correct. And he basically said, well, I don't really know if this was an aggravated robbery with a weapon. And so I'm going to give Mr. Bates the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to hold that the first juvenile offense gets a weight of zero and the second offense gets a weight of 0.5 as opposed to the 1 and 1.5. So that, I'm sorry for the length of that, but I think it was important for you to understand what happened in the Hines case and some of the factual differences in this case. And I believe there are courts personnel here to testify on this case.
Why don't you have a seat at the table and take a minute or two and
I don't believe Mr. Bates is here.
Mr. Bates here?
He's incarcerated, right? Okay.
Yes, your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Carla Heil. I am the director of the Legal Counsel Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. We agree with Ms. Timmons' analysis of Mr. Bates' claim, and I think the main points to emphasize is, unlike the Hines case, there is no appellate court that has said that the sentencing was wrong. And additionally, the state, unlike the Hines, in this case, the state does not agree that the sentence was incorrect. Mm-hmm. Additionally, one important fact is that Mr. Bates got the benefit of the bargain of a 2001 plea agreement. And just to go over the numbers of sentencing months, in 2001, as part of the plea agreement, three city misdemeanor cases were dismissed. So that was 9 months that he was not sentenced to jail. Additionally, the judge sentenced the two terms concurrently, and they for a total of 24 months from Benton and Stearns County. So that was only a 24 months. And so even using Mr. Bates's numbers, if in fact they were 18 and 31 months for 31 plus the 9, he could have possibly served 40 months in 2001. Instead, the judge gave him a 24-month sentence. And even if we used Mr. Bates' other numbers that he is saying for the final Chippewa County one, where he was sentenced to 19 months instead of 15, all total, the time 24 plus 19 is 43 months. If in fact he did not get the benefit of the plea agreement, using his numbers, it would have been 40 months plus the 15 that he is claiming for the Chippewa for a total of 55 months. So his actual time is 43, which if he didn't get the benefit of the bargain, he would have had 55 months. And so unlike Hines, there is no extra time that Mr. Bates was incarcerated.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rather than get to the merits of this particular claim, I have seen nothing in the packet that addresses whether or not Mr. Bates has a claim other than through this committee. And Rule 1 specifically says that we shall not consider a claim over which another tribunal has jurisdiction. It would seem to me that if Mr. Bates was falsely imprisoned, he would have a claim in district court where his claim could be considered. So in accordance with Rule 1, Mr. Chairman, I would move that his claim be denied. And if in the future, I suppose, if he can come in and prove that he does not have the ability to bring a claim in district court, we could reconsider. But until that happens, I don't think that this claim is properly before the committee, and I move to deny it.
Let's get right to that motion. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Do we have another item before us?
Oh, okay. The claimant's attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Who's that?
I believe that's Mr. Graham.
Okay. What are we thinking? What are we?
Yes, the final two claims are the Volkmer claims today.
He has retained counsel by the name of
John Remington Graham, I believe.
Hello. Hello, is this Mr. Graham?
Yes.
Hi, Ms. Graham. We're going to start the testimony here. So, if you just.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think what I'd like to do at this point, with 12 minutes remaining, I'd like Ms. Timmons to give us a 2 or 3 minute summary. The individual on the phone can do likewise. And then by 10 o'clock, the chair is going to offer the following motion, and that would be to continue this matter to a date and time to be determined. Time certain to be determined, and that we bring it back for discussion and or hearing. So, Ms. Timmons, proceed. Please take 2 or 3 minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, there are essentially two claims here, one of which is Volkmer against Baldwin Township, and the other one of which is Volkmer against Fabian and May, his former law firm. The total of the claims is $203,858.94 for both claims. One claim is basically alleging the wrongful conduct of the township in establishing a dive team and the wrongful termination of Mr. Volkmer as a firefighter. That's the essence of the claim against Baldwin Township. And the essence of the claim against Fabian and May is a dispute over legal fees.
We have folks at the witness table. Tell us who you are and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I thank you for giving me the time to come here today and present my claim. My name is Paul Volkmer, and I'm a former firefighter, as she mentioned, and an elected official in Baldwin Township.
I just want to remind you, Mr. Volkmer, we're
very limited.
We're not making any
yes.
decisions today. We're going to, if my motion is supported, we're going to hear this matter at a later date. So be
I understand.
Very brief. Thank you.
This is Mr. Sean Weldon. He's the former fire chief in Baldwin Township, and he's filed affidavits in my support and was here for questioning. Essentially, I want to outline for you my goals in this proceedings would be to enter my experience into the legislative record, secure financial restitution, pursue legislative action, and advocate for judicial reform. The issues pertinent to my claim include demonstrable corruption, denial of justice, denial of trial, abuse of summary judgment, non-existence of professional ethics, tampering with court cases, perjury, abuse of judicial exemption from the Data Practices Act, by denial of transcripts, lack of legal protection for whistleblowers, alteration of court records, judicial sabotage of mediation, granting motions without any notification to counsel, ignoring statutory requirements for reporting criminal acts as an elected official, bypassing of the intermediate courts, self-billing of attorneys, denial of special prosecutor or grand jury in spite of stated conflicts of interest, illegal release of supersedeas bond without any notification by a judge who had no jurisdiction in the case and failed to notify me of said release, disregard for and falsifying the claims of the state auditor's report, financial hardship, and lastly, determining that the rules of professional ethics do not apply, are not an implied covenant in a legal services contract. In other words, in the state of Minnesota, your lawyer no longer has to use ethics in dealing with his clients. My attorney, Mr. John Grand, couldn't be here today due to the short notice, but he does have in your folder a one-page statement and a short bio, and you're welcome to read that, and I'll turn it back to you.
Mr. Volkamer, a question for you. I heard your long list of items where you condemn the system, the courts, and so forth. Has your claim of $203,858.94 claim or claims, have you taken those through and up to and including the Minnesota State Supreme Court, and have you argued these very rules items there?
I have, Your Honor.
And what has been their decision?
They took 90 days and submitted a one sentence, which is in your records that I submitted to you, submitted a one sentence, Gildea, submitted a one sentence denial to review, even though I had shown criminal actions by appellate court justices.
So, Mr. Volkamer, then your claims have been heard in district court, court of appeals, the state Supreme Court, and you've not succeeded there. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this gets complicated in that we're seeing, and I think Ms. Timmons can verify this, or at least people are coming into our office and several other offices claiming a wrongful conduct by the court in terms of application of the law. And so that's why I think we need to listen to some of these things and decide. People are even going to the Board of Judicial Standards and claiming no favorable product out of those kind of claims. So I think we're starting to see things that will have to shape some testimony at some committee. I don't know if this is the right one, and maybe it is not, but I think somebody has to hear what's going on in terms of courts today and then decide what do we as the legislature need to accomplish in terms of some, whether it's reform, whether it's, and I have a Senate file that's in front of the Judicial Committee that brings some things, that would bring some things back to the legislature in terms of looking at judges and whether or not action would need to be taken there. So it gets very complicated, and I think that's why we would continue this hearing on and look at things so that we don't start bringing in a rash of things to this committee that don't belong here necessarily.
At this point, we have 6 minutes left. We'll go to the telephones. Sir, state your name and why you're on the phone, and you've got 2 minutes.
All right. My name is John Graham. I'm a member of the Minnesota Bar 3664X. I've been a lawyer for 44 years. A former law professor, a former public defender, and a public prosecutor. I'm involved in this case because I think we have now reached a point where we have to have legislative attention. The judge in this particular case held that in a legal services contract, there is no implied in law covenant of legal ethics. That is an insult to every lawyer in the state of Minnesota, and it creates a serious judicial crisis. I have stated my case in a short statement, I think about 2 pages. I want to let you know that I stand on that, and I think that if this committee should consider compensation, and or I think the House Judiciary Committee should look at this case and decide whether there can be remedial legislation and or perhaps the bill of impeachment. I stand by Mr. Volkamer as a member of the bar. I feel that this case was so badly handled that the legal profession is threatened. I really have nothing more to say other than that I stand by my statement, and I hope that you will take our plea seriously. Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This case seems to me, having been all the way to the Minnesota State Supreme Court, and the litigant was not successful. What we really are dealing with is, in the vernacular, what's called a disgruntled litigant. And while I sympathize with him, to me this would be an example of the type of case that should be brought up in the Civil Law Committee in the House, I think it would be, and in the Senate would be the Judiciary, and take a look at the Board of Judicial Standards. But for us to even consider this kind of a claim after it has already gone to the Minnesota Supreme Court, I'm going to go right back to Rule 1 and say we don't even have jurisdiction over this.
Senator Newman, go ahead.
Yeah,
we can deal with the motion before us, and then you can make a motion to deny claim, and any off-the-cuff anecdotal remarks should be very carefully worded, but I suspect the Policy and Finance Committees, as opposed to the Claims Committee, is a better venue, but go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, you might be right. I simply don't think that this is the correct committee for this claim. I would move to deny the claim. And we can bring it up legislatively in next year in a different committee.
I have a motion to continue. I'm going to withdraw my motion and entertain your motion that you've just made. Discussion. Senator Jungbar.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't. I guess I don't believe that they. Or I'm not going to vote in favor of denying the motion or the denying the claim. Because I think at some level, when somebody has this type of claim, it comes before our committee, I think we should move it into having another discussion so that we do get all the information out on the table. And when somebody comes before us with a similar claim, that we are setting in place a direction for that to handle. Right now, we're coming up with several different ideas, and I would rather have an extended discussion about that. I think this is the right place to have that discussion and then be able to know in the future where do we send folks with this kind of an issue.
Mr. Chair, I'll take a moment just to address this.
Your name?
My name is Don Massica from Monticello. I've been involved in
that. Have a seat at the table because we have an audio system recording our voices. Give us your name.
My name is Don Mashick. I'm from Monticello. This is exactly the problem that's went on. This is not the first time the citizens of the state of Minnesota have tried to bring out the fact that the Minnesota judiciary is systemically corrupt. For 7 years, myself and hundreds of other citizens have petitioned both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to give evidence and testimony of corruption in the Minnesota judiciary and been refused. This is a blatant attempt to block citizens' right to petition the government for redress of grievances. This is a First Amendment right. I don't know how you explain for 7 years. 7 years, hundreds of citizens. There's a videotape of an ad hoc deal that we put together in 2009 because we couldn't get in front of either House Judiciary Committee. And so you leave us with these little instances of somehow trying to get out the word that the Minnesota courts are systemically corrupt. I don't know Paul Volkmer from Adam until I found out that the judge that screwed him over is the same judge that screws me over. And we have stuff like for 3 months a judge wouldn't schedule a hearing and then says, oh, your motions are untimely because she refused to have a hearing for 3 months.
Sir, watch your language. And we're on the Volkmer case, not on a blanket condemnation of the judiciary. And your time, you've got 15 seconds, and then we're going to bring the motion back.
I'm done.
Motions before the committee. Senator Newman's motion. Further discussion, hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Any other business to come before this claims committee?
Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to just recognize Jackie Dutcher, who has been our claims clerk and has kept us organized and done just a wonderful job, and she is going to be expanding her work as a community service officer for the Eden Prairie Police Department. So she'll be leaving us, and Friday is her last day.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Anything further? If not, committee stands adjourned.
Yes.
Yep.